Hey, well, thank you for Rob and Lucien for organizing the this very nice event and inviting me and helping to conclude. As a conclusion, I thought I will give some not very hard formalism or results, but I will probably touch on many things that have been discussed. And I want to start from what I believe are some motivations for studying what we call indefinite causal structures. And personally, I have at least three levels of motivations. So one I will say is sort of purely foundational. So we know that quantum mechanics tells us that that there are quantum properties that are that physical systems, physical quantities have quantum properties that are very different from classical and have been observed in many scenarios. And a question that arises is, what about causal structure? And the underlying question is really, what do we mean by causal structure? So it's we often have the word causality popping in different parts of our theories, physics, scientific methods. It is a sort of foundational question to ask, do quantum properties apply to something like causal structure? And what we really want to do at this level is tease out what do we actually mean by causal structure. And I would like to say that this type of motivation is by itself not necessarily linked to specific applications of this concept, because we might reason about what does it mean to have a quantum causal structure before discovering situations in which this might be relevant. But then, of course, we wouldn't have this strong motivation if we didn't have scenarios where we believe it's relevant. And the one that is has been mostly discussed here is the scenario where we put together quantum mechanics and gravity. So this is, I'm referring to the argument by Lucien Hardy, but this has been also formulated in different ways in different times. There is this idea that space-time has some classical causal structure. If we start to quantize gravity and we can quantize space-time, and there is a question, what happens to causal structure? Does it become quantum, and what does it mean? But then there is a third reason that I believe has not been discussed much, which is we found that indefinite causal structure can also be considered as practical resources. And now, what does it mean is that if we consider indefinite causal structure, so now this is a representation of, I will not ask you at this level to follow all the details, but we imagine that we have different events, and by events, now I'm imagining different operations, practical operation on a system that we might perform to perform some task. And say we have three operations. If we imagine to be able to, in a way, superpose the order between the operations, so we can do 0, 1, 2 in superposition with 2, 1, 0, and so on, we might consider that it might be possible to achieve some task that will require us to perform these operations more times. So here, at least at the formal level, it looks like if we admit indefinite causal structure, we can save on the number of times we can perform certain operations. So here I'm mostly referring to what we call a query complexity advantage. But there are actually many different advantages that in a way some are more and some are less clear what they actually mean. But it seems that at least from the point of view of motivation, it looks like we might get something practical out of it. And how practical is it? Do we need planets in superposition? Well, it looks like not really. There have been some experiments that have been performed that at least claim to have achieved, to have realized the resources that will be necessary to get this advantage. And now a natural question that will be sort of at the background of my talk is, what is the relation between these last two concept I described? Now, this seems to be something very different. One is we are saying, well, we need, when we take quantum physics and gravity, we get indefinite causal structure, some very exotic scenario. And the other is some relatively mundane, from the standpoint of quantum physicists, quantum experimentalists, some mundane experimental setup. There is no big mass here. There are some lasers. What's the relation between these two things? So should we think that this is actually a simulation of the causal structure, the quantum causal structure over there? And if it's a simulation, is it actually useful as a resource? And so this is sort of the type of question that I would like to address by the end of the talk. And so to give a brief outlook of what to expect in the next around 30, 40 minutes. So I would like, first of all, to give a very brief introduction to what I think is relevant concepts of causal structure for the purpose of what I'm going to talk about. So the main point is that, well, there are different notions of causal structure, that different things that we might go by that name, and it's important to distinguish them. Then I will consider the scenario where we imagine the causal structure, the indefinite causal structure from some sort of a quantum space-time, and I will go through to this gravitational switch, which has been mentioned already a few times in previous talks, and I will try to maybe describe a few more details, possibly also answer some questions if there are any. And then go to the lab scenario, and I will would like to compare some of the existing implementation and describe what we might call the single use problem. Is it true that you are performing one operation in superposition of time, or are you performing two operations? And propose some new scheme that to some extent fixes some of the problems that appear in the previous implementations. Okay, so what is a causal structure? So, well, we might have very, very different opinion, many different definitions, but very broadly we can say some kind of set of relations between events. And to understand what this means, we have to understand what type of relations are we talking about, and of course we have to define what type of events. And I will say the definition of events is really the main point that will lead us, or at least one of the crucial differences that will lead us to a different definition of causal structure. So one of the concepts that I will say is relevant in practical applications. So if you want to consider causal structure for practical purposes, you want to say what does it mean that A causes B in practical scenario, has to do with what we can generally call the interventions or manipulation theory. This was mentioned by Doreen. So in this context, what we call event is some relatively broad and context-dependent thing. It's any quantity that can be observed and intervened on. So I imagine that there is an event is, I don't know, it's like the construction of a car, and I can observe how the car is constructed, and I can intervene and change some part of the car. And then some other event can be the car driving through the traffic. So these are not really the type of events we typically consider in physics, because they're not really localized in space-time, but they're very valid type of events, and you may want to infer causal relations between things. And a causal relation in this context is simply defined between what we may call the free intervention. So in this context, you have to assume that you're able to identify some variables that you can change independently of the rest of the context, so you can intervene on. And so the causal relations are correlations between your intervention and observation of other variables. So my example is, I live in Brisbane, in Australia. So this is an example of relation A to B. If I put a carrot on my porch, every time a possum comes and eats the carrot. So the carrot is the cause, and the possum eating is the effect. And I'd like to stress, possums are Australian possums are not the same as American possums. They're very cute. No offense for American possums. Now there is, of course, a very different, at least substantially different notion of causal structure that that we very often talk about. Yes?
Sorry, Fabian, was that going to be your definition of causal relation? Or merely a necessary condition, or merely a sufficient condition?
I will say this is a definition of interventionist causation. Okay. This is the...
What about the Vernon cipher example? So the plain text does not correlate with the cipher text, but...
It is a modulo intervening on sufficiently many variables. If you intervene on both, so you have the cipher and the text. Just to remind what's the problem, I have a message that I want to send, and I code the message. So I code with a random string. So if I change the message, I don't change, I cannot really see a change in the final send message, because if I don't know the code, so it will be completely random. But the point is that if I do change the code, if I have control on both message and code, then I can see that both of them together have a causal influence on the message. So that's how we understand in causation in this sense. You need to have at least a counterfactually access to sufficiently many variables to be able to define interventionist causation.
So would it be fair to say that as a consequence of that, you can have the case that A is not a cause of B and C is not a cause of B, but the set AC is a cause of B?
You could define things in this way, but I think it's not the most useful. I think more useful is that you have to set what are the relevant variables in your context, and then A is a cause of B if there is a choice of all, there is a fixed choice of all other variables for which A is correlated to B. So this is really nothing but the definition of signaling that we use in quantum information or in information theory. So it's, if you have a multipartite setting to define signal between A and B, it has to be relative to, it must mean that it is true for at least one choice of the variables, of all other variables that are there. And if your context is really that you don't have access to the cipher, to the key, then in that context, it's really true that your text doesn't cause the message. So if really somehow this is forever lost in a black hole, then in that case, you will end up saying, yeah, it's actually, from the point of view of interventionist causation, the cipher doesn't cause the text because there isn't any accessible correlation in that case. But that's let's say, I think the most useful way to think about it is really where you have access to all the relevant variables. So of course, if you throw away some relevant variable, then there might be some counterintuitive situation.
And you decide what are the relevant variables based on a preconceived notion of what's causally relevant?
Like, so this is a practical notion, and so it's obviously very, very context dependent. And so how much it's useful is going to be of how good the context you choose.
if there's a situation where I don't know, you know, what, I have uncertainty about what causes what.
Yeah.
So maybe I look at a bunch of variables and I say, even intervening on all of these doesn't allow me to manipulate B. I can't conclude that they're not causes because maybe there's some other variable out there, and if I furthermore intervene on that, then suddenly I see that I can change.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
That's the idea.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So this is, of course there are many versions of causation. One could try to define causation purely based on correlations. The notion of intervention typically plays a role in all definitions that try to have a practical use from the point of view of what causes what. You might find versions that don't rely uniquely on interventions or might put intervention as a certain type of variable, exogenous variable. But just to simplify that, let's say for the purpose of this talk, I think this is a quite good description of what we mean by causation in practical terms, when we want to say, I do something here and observe an effect there. The other concept is rather different. It's a very geometrical concept. And I think it's important to distinguish that this concept a priori doesn't seem to have much to do with the second one. A bit technically, we say events are points in a space-time manifold. So we think, more generally, an event is a location, a place and a time where something can happen. And the causal structure is simply identify with a partial order of events, with the ordering of events defined by light cones. So here we have some concept of geometry. We think in terms of, to fix the ideas, I think concretely in terms of Lorentzian geometry on a space-time manifold. And we talk about this kind of geometrical relation. So what's the relation between these two concepts? Well, first of all, the idea that the reason this geometrical concept is useful at all is that we assume that imposes some constraints on the dynamics. So it's not that we only have a pure space-time with nothing on it. What we have is fields, particles, things that happen on this space-time, and these things are described by some dynamical laws. And the space-time geometry constrains the dynamical laws. How this relates to the previous concept So now if we choose some particular type of notion of intervention, so if we think about a localized intervention in spacetime, so we think we have spacetime and some stuff on spacetime that satisfies some laws, and then we imagine some scenario where we can intervene on this stuff, so do something that doesn't directly satisfy the laws, then the structure of spacetime and of the dynamical laws will impose constraints between the causal relations between my interventions and my observations. So there is a way to talk about interventions in physics, and you can talk about localized interventions, and typically the causal structure matches in the sense that if I do an intervention here and I have a causal spacetime and dynamical laws are reasonable enough, then I will see the effects in the future light cone. So these are the two different notions of causal structure. It's I would like to refer to, and So the thing is that typically we use a shortcut and we call causal structure only the geometrical structure of the light cones, which is fine as a definition, but we should remember that in principle, it's a different concept. So one can say that the geometrical notion of causal structure imposes constraint to the relation between interventions and observations. Any question on this general attitude towards causal relations? Okay, so with this in mind, yep.
Am I right in thinking that one difference between this and the previous one is that light cone structure is really about the possibility of causal connection, not the actuality? Just because something's in my future doesn't mean I'm causing it, but I could possibly cause it.
That's right. So it imposes constraints on the causal relations. So it means that if I'm space-like, I cannot cause, but if I'm time-like, I can cause, and then I can put more constraints. If I'm, for example, if I have three regions and one screens off the other one, then I will have a causal screening off of these three regions. So it imposes constraint on what type of causal structure you have for interventions that are localized in space-time. And maybe let me stress that this is, I'm saying this a bit very intuitively, but it's actually not completely obvious that if you put some dynamic and some way to define interventions, that this is true. It's typically true if you take something like an electromagnetic field, that then interventions is shaking some charge, and you define things properly. But if you take some wild dynamics, it's not completely obvious that you might have a scenario that perhaps satisfy Lorentz symmetry, but where the relation between cause effect and is somehow different. It's not entirely obvious, let's say. It's just typically true in the way we use physics, but one could imagine, the thing is that typically we don't necessarily need this notion of cause effect to define geometry and dynamics. It's rather helpful for us to make sense of experiments and get an intuition of what's going on in some physical scenario. And in general, if you have some very strange physics, it may not even be true. So just to make some cover. For the purpose of this talk, think that it is true, that if we make an intervention here, it will only be have effect in the future light bulb. Okay, with this in mind, let's see how putting quantum and gravity together changes causal structure. And for this part, I really want to at least try to talk about the geometrical notion of causal structure, how putting quantum and gravity together changes this notion of underlying structure that imposes constraints on cause-effect relations. So first of all, so now I'm going to describe... This scenario is based on this work with Magdalena Zik, Igor Pikowski, and Joseph Bruckner. And essentially, the point of this work is to present a concrete realization of a scenario where we can say, in rather intuitive and clear and well-defined terms, that there is an indefinite causal structure arising. So the point of the exercise is to try to spell out, not simply look at the formalism and say, causal structure looks indefinite, but come up with an explicit thought experiment. And so to make sense, to understand this thought experiment, first of all, we have to understand how do we define space-time events. So we take the approach of general relativity that space-time events should be I mean, ideally, abstractly, we think of them as abstract events in a manifold, but concretely, these events in a manifold should anyway be pointed at by some physical event. So concretely, we think that we have some clock, and we want to say, if we want to say we have a certain space-time event, we have to say this is the time at which a certain clock is at a certain time. Given this, what does it mean that general relativity has a dynamical causal structure for practical purposes? So we can consider this scenario where we have we define two events, A and B, relative to two different clocks. And we initialize the clocks such that if this is in completely flat space-time, the two events are space-like separated. But now we introduce some mass, so we keep the initialization of the clock, but we introduce some mass, and we consider two possible configurations of the mass. If we put it to the right, it time delays this clock, so such that the event B, which is still defined the same way locally, it's still 2 o'clock of this clock, it ends up in the future light cone of A, because the mass time dilates B relative to A. Or we can consider the mass as put next to the clock A, and then we end up with A being in the future of B. So what it means is that the causal order between events, and events are defined relative to clocks, depends on the position of a mass on the configuration. So now to transfer this to something about events on physical system that we can link to some cause-effect relations that we can observe. We imagine some that at this event, so when the clock, say it's at 2 o'clock, at event A, we perform some operation on some other system that goes through that point. And so we imagine that we describe the action of this operation by some Krauss operator. So this could be, for example, some unitary operation. And in this scenario, we have this target system. It goes first A and then B, and so the operations are done in this order. And in this other scenario, they are done in the opposite order. Just to say, well, okay, this is some technicality that maybe is not really important. And now the point is that if quantum theory is universal, if we assume that we can extend the superposition principle to arbitrary masses, then we should conclude that we can assign orthogonal state to the mass to the right and mass to the left. And furthermore, we can prepare a situation that is a superposition of these two states. And so what happens there? We start with superposition right plus left, and we end up with this superposition of having performed A before B or B before A. So this is the result. So this is what we call a quantum switch, the fact that we can create a control superposition, or we can say entangle the order of the operation with some control system. So this is sort of the way we can translate a quantum gravitational scenario into a something we can call indefinite causal order. Now the argument can be done a bit stronger, a bit more complicated. I will not go through this complicated graph. Just imagine first we had A and B, now we can consider two pairs of A1, B1, A2, B2. And we can construct a Bell-like scenario where you can prove at the end of the day, you can make a strong statement that says, I finally perform some experiments that tell me that are inconsistent with any local and classical description of causal structure. And so this is very much like in Bell inequalities, where you do some experiment and say, my results are inconsistent with a local classical description. Here, the local classical description is about the causal structure. OK, so this is the basic scenario. So we have two events, and we can control the order of these two events by preparing quantum states of the mass. Now we can start to ask some questions. Now, is it really true that these are two events? Now, if you look at the picture, the way I've drawn them, actually, these events occupy different spots in the picture. Now, this is really just an effect of the picture that I've drawn, but it's a fully consistent picture in the sense that I can define some foliation of space-time that are common for the two configuration of the mass. So I can define foliation of space-time independent relative to some coordinate that are defined independent of the metric. So relative to this foliation for each space-time, I can define a time evolution. And I can make this, because this time evolution only refers to moving from a coordinate to the next, it's actually independent of the mass. So we can intuitively say this is the point of view of an observer that is far away and whose clock is not time dilated by this mass. And so from this point of view, we can even write a Hamiltonian. So this is all in the supplementary material of our paper. So we can describe this everything as a time evolution in terms of an Hamiltonian that also affects the local clocks. And we end up with the same result. And so from this picture, it looks like we have four space-time events, so four coordinates. And so it looks like depending on which coordinate we choose, we have either two geometrical events or four geometrical events. Still, the point is that if we keep believing that the physical definition of events is related to the definition of local clock, we should still say that we have still two physical events. So what does it mean? It simply means that now say that event A, from the perspective of these coordinates, is not localized in time. So you can choose one coordinate that is, say, attached to the clock, for which A is localized in time, and some other coordinate for which it's not localized in time. And so this is something we have heard a few times in this conference. So this is a practical way to see that we cannot really assign an absolute localization to physical events when we start to put masses in superposition. Okay. So actually, yes.
So even though the events can be identified, the thing you're doing at the events is different.
Why?
On this side, A is sending something, and on this side, A is receiving.
No, in both cases, both are sending and receiving. So if you look locally, what happens at A receives some system, X, and sends away a system, and also B receives the system, X, and sends away the system. It's just that in this scenario, the system that Bob sends away, it doesn't go back, it doesn't influence Alice. Well, in this case, the system that Bob sends away is the one that receives Alice. But locally, the operation is still one operation on a system. And as far as they know, they cannot really tell if this system is coming from Bob or not. I mean, they can only tell by making a measurement, but the measurement is described by this same operation. So you have, a photon, you're making an operation on your photon, and it might be that it's coming from Bob or not, and you don't know unless you know where was the mass, or you know some other aspect of the experiment.
Isn't there a difference
in the angle?
In the direction. One's
right, so this was the caveat that I skipped over. So you can arrange all these scenarios such that really it's everything locally indistinguishable. So you can arrange that such that the angle and everything else is locally the same. You can't really say by looking at the configuration of your experiment in the lab, it's completely neutral with respect to where this mass goes. So this is not completely obvious, but you can arrange things such that it works that way.
This is described.
Yeah.
Just a thought. Maybe I missed. So you would say that here this is the same event, right?
Or
you're just posing the question.
Yeah. So from the point of view, if you want to talk about physical events in terms of an action performed at the given time relative to a local clock, then yes, this is an event.
If I could create a classical copy of the same thing somewhere else later in time, is it the same event?
Classical copy?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I create the same situation once more later in time.
Well, this is a repetition, then will be a repetition of the same type of experiment. So you will have to do that if you want to get statistics. You will have to do this many times. But then it's not the same event anymore because it will not be the same particle. It will be a new preparation and so on.
So you're defining an event to its world line. Or I'm trying to get it. For example, somebody might say, yeah, but this is not the same event because everything else with respect to it in the universe is different. Therefore, somehow, how do you identify an event? Maybe.
Well, how do you identify? Yeah, so the only way I know is to say I get a clock, and at 2 o'clock and I do something. That's the only way I know how to identify an event. There isn't a God-given way to tell me this is the point in space-time and that's an event.
No, my point is that in the two different scenarios, there is an event that does that.
Yeah.
But we want to identify it. We want to say it's the same event.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. That the only way I know how to identify is that I call one event, the operation done on the particle at 2 o'clock. That's the only way I know how to identify events. In both scenarios, this is
true. Create another just next to it clock. And...
But it's a different clock.
Yeah,
so the clock gives you both space and time reference because it's an object at the given location. So if you have another clock, then it's another event. Joseph?
I don't know.
Yeah, but
you
calculate all that this clock is the same because it is next to it, there are different things going on. I mean, based on what do I know that this is another?
So maybe Joseph has.
I mean, the clock is a kind of abstraction of all degrees of freedom in the lab with respect to which you perform your operation. And if that is everything what you have in accessible is identical in both cases, there is absolutely no way to distinguish this things, and that's an identical event from the local observer point of view.
So, okay, maybe we should, well, I'm already eating up all my time, but let's say that it's not that it's completely issue-free, this identification and so on, but let me say this is the identification we use in general relativity. So that's one that seems to be working and relatively solid. Then, of course, you can start to introduce a lot of caveats, but I believe that this should be solid enough, so maybe we can discuss more later on the subtlety. Maybe in interest of time, you can go forward. Let me say that, yes, you can make a case that there are different ways, even in this scenario, in which you can identify the event. And so maybe let me say what I believe is some operational way to characterize what I call geometrical events, as to distinguish some events that are not really localized in space-time in any meaningful way. So I would like to characterize in this way. We'll say an event is geometrical, so it sort of corresponds to what I would like to call a point in space-time. If it's labeled relative to what I imagine a black box represents, so like clock. And black box, it means that I have this system that gives me a time and space reference, but I don't really know how it works. I don't know if it's an atomic clock, I don't know if it's some other device. It should be just something that in some reliable way gives me a time and space label. And my protocol should independent of the choice of a physical reference system. So no matter what type of black box I choose, my protocol of violating Bell inequalities or performing any experiment that points to an indefinite causal structure should be indefinite for independent of the particular choice of physical system. That's what I will say. Is the definition of what supports the idea that there is a geometrical notion of events. Because then I can interpret the results as saying, well, it's not really because of the particular clock I was using, it's really because it's space-time that is telling me there is this point or this other point. And then the obvious conclusion is that if we try to use this definition in a classical and causal space-time, so without close some curves, then we cannot really create any indefinite causal structure, indefinite causal order in classical space time if events are localized in this way. So how much time do I have left?
So you've had 32 minutes, you've got 18 minutes left.
Okay, so we should have time. Okay, so just the conclusion, by this definition of events, which I think is what kind of should replace a notion of space-time, at least at an operational level, in a scenario where we don't have a single manifold description. We can say that if we have a single manifold description, then we cannot really get indefinite causal order in the geometrical sense if we have a classical space-time. And so now let me switch to the second part or third part of the talk. So what about then this indefinite causal structure, this famous experiment, indefinite causal structure in the lab? What are they? In what sense are they indefinite? Or in what sense are causal? Or in what sense are they structures? So first, before going into the detail, to understand what is the trick. So here we have a scenario that we can reliably describe in terms of classical space-time. We can imagine, ideally, to lay out classical clocks and rods everywhere. And the point is that we perform some operations that are, so what we call events are some things that are delocalized in space-time. So So now we are switching to this a bit more practical notion of causal structure, where we become more free to define what we call events. So we don't require anymore that our events are at this particular point of our background spacetime, but we allow our events for our own convenience to be delocalized. And so at this very general level, it's not very surprising that you can have indefinite causal structure. If your event is over here and the other event is over here, things can in principle go back and forth. And so that's not very surprising. You can create any type of correlation in this way. What is interesting is that the experiments that are realized, or this idea of this protocol, now referring to Ognjen's talk and his paper, we can actually describe these events not as generic events that are delocalized in time, but as single events that act on the localized subsystems. Now, this is a concept that is not really familiar from the usual formulation of quantum mechanics, because in the usual formulation, we associate subsystems to region of space. So we imagine there is a Hilbert space associated with the whole region and then tensor factors. But there are formulations of quantum mechanics where you can associate tensor factors to time. And then you can describe these events by taking some subsystem. So this will, these events will take place on commuting the tensor factors of these time delocalized things. And this will not be true for arbitrary things that you throw in space time. You have to perform some particular case. If you want some intuition, you can think you have two regions of space, and you can have many situations in two regions of space, but in particular, you can have a single particle that's in superposition of here and there. That's a particular type of scenario which is different from having, say, two particles. So the analogy is that here you have an event that is in superposition of before and after, which is different from having two events. So to maybe make try to use the power of analogy a little bit. So the thing is that if you describe these scenarios in this way, they really look like formally the same as the gravitational scenario I described before. So the analogy I want to... Yeah. The
previous slide, when you say classical space-time there,
yeah.
You mean geometrical.
Yeah.
Notionally, you're
yeah. Mathematical. Yeah. So the analogy I want to make is thinking special relativity. If you learn special relativity, you are happy to concern yourself with the global inertial reference frame. That's the main thing you want to discuss about. Now, when you go to general relativity, this thing, global inertial frame, doesn't really exist. So you are kind of forced to consider arbitrary non-inertial frames. But then nothing stops you from considering non-inertial frames also in special relativity. So in a way, here we can consider a particular class of coordinate systems that is suitable for flat space time, but we can also consider more general coordinate system. Nothing stops you from putting yourself in an accelerated frame. And so the analogy is that if we have a classical space time, we can concern ourselves with the classical space time picture, where our events are localized in space time. But we learn that when we start to superpose space time, we can consider more general. Scenario. So we don't really have one classical picture, so we are forced to consider some type of quantum coordinate transformation. But now nothing stops us to go back and describe scenarios in classical space-time using coordinate quantum transformation. It might be useful or not, but that's a possibility. And so that's how one can think about those switches in classical space-time. You have a coordinate system where a quantum coordinate system where these two events are actually one event. Okay, so this is all fine, and theoretically, I guess one can make some formal manipulation, but now the question is, okay, is it really useful for something? Because now we said, okay, we change the way we assign events, you do your experiment, can you really do something good with that? And so now I would like, in the time remaining, I would like to briefly compare the different implementations that have been done. There are essentially three classes of implementation that differ by what type of degrees of freedom are used for the control, what decides the order between operation and target, what is the target operation. Now, we'll mostly focus on these two, not because I'm a co-author of those, but because this third one, while it has a lot in common with the first, because the control is position, so it will share some of the problems, and it has some additional problem because actually in the way this experiment is realized, you need a resolution between the first time where something goes through and second time. So if anything, the definition of single operation in this experiment is more problematic, at least more, but as problematic, but more as in the other one. And so these are the two main setups that I want to describe. So this is the Vienna experiment. The control is position. So you prepare a superposition of a photon going this way or that way. And the target is a set of lenses that acts on polarization. And so you see that if you go this way, you go first A, then B, and then you interfere again. If you go this way, you go B, then A, then interfere again. And so you, if you have a superposition, you have a superposition of the two orders. In this other setup, the control is polarization, and the target is orbital angular momentum, so it's the shape of the beam. This is the experiment Christina referred to a couple of days ago. So here you have a polarizing beam splitter, which means that if you have a horizontal polarization, you are transmitted. If you are vertical, you are reflected. And so you see that if you are horizontal, you go through A, and then horizontal again, go through, and then, goes around, and then B, and go out. And if you are vertical, you are reflected, B, reflected, go around, reflect.
You have to go to the
mirror. Sorry, what? Reflected B.
No.
No?
Go up to the mirror.
Here. So I'm reflected.
The mirror.
So I start from here.
Yes.
I go up, I'm reflected.
Yes.
I go this way.
Yes.
Then I go this way.
Yep.
B, I'm reflected.
Yes.
Go this way, this way.
The mirror. Yes.
Yes. Then I'm reflected and A. It's a very clever setup. So okay, and then the operations are performed on the orbital angular momentum, so the shape of the beam. So the thing that one can say intuitively here is that okay, here you have if you are in the AB branch, you are going through this point. If you are in the BA branch, you go through this point. So this kind of intuitively tells us that. It looks like there are two different operations depending if you're trying to do AB or BA. So what entitles us to identify this operation is just to say that, well, these things are very close and these wave plates don't really know the difference, and my only control in the experiment is rotating the wave plate, so no matter how I control, I do the same thing. And similar here, I have a different polarization going through depending on the orders. And the way we should argue is that the operation on the target doesn't really depend on the polarization. Now, this is nice in words, but in the reality, that's not really true. So this is why I think there are some limitations in this implementation when you come to the interpretation of the single use. And now this single use interpretation definition of what does it mean we are using one box, the same box once, or two box twice. It's perhaps not entirely clear foundationally what it should mean. So I would like to refer this to some more practical notion that at the end of the day, I think will has a strong impact if we want to try to use these setups for practical purposes, for advantages. So the point is that the main point is that the control degree of freedom is traveling with the particle. And so here locally, you can imagine in principle, you can do an operation that distinguishes A and B, and A1 from A2. And in practice, you sort of have to be careful to make sure that this doesn't happen. And in fact, in the actual experiment, the action of this operation does act on the control. So, here it's quite manifest because the lenses we use actually act on polarization, so you have to put some compensating length such that it actually is the same thing. But here too, it's a bit more subtle because here the control is in fact spread out. It's the two paths are spread out everywhere, and so you have a phase, a relative phase between the two states of the control, which is not really independent on what you're doing on the target. So again, here you have to compensate and put some phase shifter somewhere to compensate the fact that your control is not really independent of the target. And so this is a problem practically because you have to compensate this to make sure you're not actually messing up the control. And the next very big limitation is that these setups are intrinsically not scalable. So the idea is that we want to use these setups to get an advantage in the use of resources. But now if you think, for example, try to scale this up to permutation of many boxes. You will have to use one position for each position for each of the permutations. So, which means you will need exponentially many positions if you want to do. So if you want to do n permutation of n boxes, you will need exponentially many positions. And so you will very soon run out of space, and they will stop doing the same thing. And something similar is here. In principle, you could encode efficiently by having more photons. But then the target is really not encoded efficiently because it's encoded in the in this orbital angular momentum, which again scale not efficiently. And so in the time left, which is how much? Five?
5 minutes.
I want to very briefly propose a new implementation of the switch, which I believe overcomes most of the limitations. So so just to say, this implementation is based on current technology. Don't ask me too much about the actual technological details because I don't know, but I know what function it should perform. So the essential elements is this optical router. So the idea of a router is that, I can show it, that you have some atom, you have some light coupled to some resonator system, and there is some atom inside here, and the atom has two possible energy levels. And so if you're in the ground state, you have two optical modes that come in. If you're in the ground state, the modes are transmitted. If you're in the excited state, the modes are reflected. This is this is one of the papers where this has been implemented, but many groups are working on this type of systems. And now the way to implement the switch, we just need one little extra element, which is an optical circulator. What it does, it circulates light clockwise. So if I come this way, I go out this way. But if I come this way, I go down this way. And this is some non-reversible optical element. And so the key feature of this setup is that the control system is not physically separated from the target. And these black boxes here are supposed to be some box where the photons, where you can perform operations on the target system, which we still think is some property of a photon. And the idea is that a photon comes here, you transfer the internal degrees of freedom to, say, some quantum memory, you perform the operation there, and then you send the system out. And so if you look how this works, you send the system, a bunch of photons in, they all go together here. If you're in the ground state, you're reflected, you go to A. Sorry, you're transmitted, and you go to A. And then you're transmitted back, go down, transmitted, go to B, go down, and go out. If you are, if this is in an excited state, that you're reflected, B, go down, reflected, A, go down, and go out. And so you see that this performs the operation of the switch. But now the point is that the control system is not available in the place where we do the operation, and so it's easier to ensure that these operations will not mess up with the control. And the next good news is that this can be scaled up. If you want to control n operations, you only need order n square atoms. And another good news is that you actually don't need to prepare them in any entangled states. If you just have a product state, you can perform almost all the permutations. And so this is scalable. So you could imagine really using this setup for getting some useful advantage. And an open question, this is not the optimal way to encode permutation. The optimal way is n log n, because there are n factorial permutation. And so it's an open question if there is some kind of quick sort way to perform these issues. And so as a summary, I've discussed what is the meaning of causal structure, and I try to distinguish, to give some operational definition of space-time events, as opposed to some practical notion of event. I've described the gravitational switch, which shows in a practical, in a concrete way, how the indefinite causal structure of space-time can become manifest. And the consequence is that there is no localization, no absolute localization of events. And finally, I've discussed the quantum switch in the lab, which formally, it's fair enough to describe it as an indefinite causal order, if you allow for a description of time delocalized events. But then current experiments have a severe limitation, which I believe can be overcome with a new type of setup, which is within the type of technology which is currently developed for building quantum computers and quantum devices. So that's it. Thank you.
We probably have time just for one question.
I would just like to, because we bring this discussion again and again, and I would like just to have you as to say a statement about that, namely that There are differences in different implementations, and this last one seems very promising, and also for the scaling and so on. But there is, would you agree that all implementations are the general implementations according to the definition of the event and causal relations as you introduce them, and with which
yeah.
we are, agree? And as you said, event could be delocalized in time, it could be also delocalized in space. And only what we have to ensure that the operation that has been performed on either in different space points in space or time are the same, which will, even if they were not the same problem, we will not get this data that we have it, or we can make some tomography of different polarization sent through the crystal or different points. Would you agree that this?
Yeah. So what I would say is that for the experiment that have been performed, yes, you can do, for example, a tomography. Well, actually, not with those experiments, but a near to tomography of your setup, and you would relative to these operations you are performing, the switch is the correct. It's a correct representation, and we know formally how to match it with a temporal description. So I would say yes, that's. That's true. The question is it surprising? Is it new? Is it useful? That's why. So I think it's important to tease out these feelings. Is it single operations or not? Because it matches what can actually be practical. And the other way around, what can be practical gives a way to interpret what do we mean by single use, single event. So I think that's why it's good to keep these two levels at the same time. So the formal level, I'm perfectly happy to call them indefinite causal structure, but. You know, we just define, we give the definition such that it fits with what we want to say. So.
Okay, let's thank Fabian and